In 1941, before they became two of the most important designers in American history, Charles Eames proposed to Ray Kaiser in a short letter written on stationery from Cranbrook Academy of Art in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, where he was on staff, complete with annotations, illustrations, and an asterisk.
I am 34 almost years old, single again and broke. I love you very much and would like to marry you very, very soon. I cannot promise to support us very well, but if given the chance, I would sure in hell try.
She said yes. They married that year and remained married until his death on August 21, 1978. She died 10 years later on the exact same day. There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today, for our special Valentine's episode, we explore several kinds of love, from the boomtown couple that paved the way for Philbrook, to a depiction of Cupid in a tapestry dating back centuries, and how artists explore their own desires through their work. First up is Susan Green, Philbrook's Associate Curator for Special Collections, Archives, and Research. This is our Valentine's Day episode, and Philbrook was built in 1927. It started being built in 1926, but Waite and Genevieve Phillips, the couple that founded Philbrook, have kind of an interesting story all their own. What do you know about how they met, where they came from? Waite Phillips is not even from Oklahoma. How did they get here?
How did they get here? That's a great story. And thinking about all the people that have been transplants to Oklahoma, and Waite and Genevieve were two of those people. So Waite Phillips grew up in Iowa. Small town. He had a twin brother, went on a Wild West adventure. Tragically, his brother died, and he has to come home. He comes home to Iowa. He's at loose ends. He doesn't know what to do. And he has two older brothers, Ellie and Frank, and they start kind of putting their little fingers in the soup to try to make things happen. And he goes to school for a whole 6 months. He gets a degree in accounting.
A degree in 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Degree at, I think, Western Normal School, so a university. But one of his brothers is on the board of a coal company. So he goes to work as a bookkeeper at the Hawkeye Coal Company. And this happens to be in Knoxville, Iowa. And while he's there, this is around 1903. So during the summer, he goes to a party and he sees a beautiful young woman. She happens to be a very sweet 16. And he gets hooked. He totally gets hooked. And her name was Genevieve Elliott. She was the daughter of one of the bankers in town, so mover and shaker in town. And they have a very long, extended courtship. They finally get married when she's 21.
Well, 5 years of courting.
Exactly. And he's back and forth. He works in Knoxville for a while. He's a teamster in Chicago for a while. He travels around, but he's always writing her letters. She writes him back letters. And then he finally ends up in Oklahoma. The older brothers start a bank and an oil business in what is Indian Territory. He ends up in Oklahoma, and he finally decides he needs to make it official. And so he goes back to Iowa, and he marries Genevieve, and then he brings her to Oklahoma.
So they get married in Iowa.
Yeah. He's quoted as saying it's the best deal he ever made. And we don't have as many things written by her and as many letters and journals, but she apparently was so sweet and kind and thoughtful. She was very much part of his business life, but sort of an underground part of his life. He used her as a sounding board. And she was a young person in Iowa, moved to Oklahoma, totally was up for the adventure. And then, of course, they made it big in the oil business and had a wonderful life together.
They had two kids.
They have two kids.
Elliot, who was named after mm-hmm. her maiden name. And then they had Helen.
Helen Jane.
Helen Jane. And so they build Philbrook in 1927. They move in. It's this massive villa based off a kind of Italian Renaissance-style villa. Four people. You know, I'm sure there were helpers and staff and all these different things, but there are four people living in this house. He was probably busy doing all kinds of stuff because, you know, a couple of years later, stock market crashes. Wade Phillips was famously not invested much, if at all, in the stock market. So he didn't see the downside of the market crash. A lot of his peers probably did at that time. So they were living a pretty high life through the 1930s. And then Philbrook opens in 39.
Yeah.
What was their relationship like while they were here in Tulsa, like living at Philbrook? Do we know anything kind of about them at that time?
Most of what we know are letters from when they were apart. She was very engaged in the community, as Mr. Phillips was. Mr. Phillips was very much a businessman, always looking out, you know, for the next opportunity. He was ready to move a lot. So, you know, they only lived at Philbrook for 11 years. But she was very concerned with people and family and the community. We do know they had a second house in New Mexico, also built by the same architect.
This is Edward Bueller Delk.
Edward Bueller Delk. So, and this was Villa Filmonte, and they later gave the home and the property to the Boy Scouts. There was a fish camp miles away from the actual house, and it took 2 days on horseback to get to this fish camp where they loved to go fishing, fly fishing. And Mrs. Phillips had to organize everything. Of course, they had staff, they had people to help, but she was sort of the linchpin for all of the work to get everyone together, all of the equipment, all of the food, to get everyone from the little town of Cimarron, New Mexico, where Villa Filmonte is, up into the mountains to fish camp. And at least once, maybe twice, General Dawes, who was the Vice President of the United States, came with his family. And so if you can imagine taking a 2-day horseback ride into the mountains to go fishing for at least a week and having the Vice President of the United States and his family, including kids, and figuring out how to get everyone up there safely, what people like to eat, to drink, all of the bedding, everything ready and up into the mountains. So she had to figure all of that out.
She was kind of the ringmaster.
She was
kind of pulling all these things together. A very big organizing task.
I think so. I think she kept everything together.
So that's a kind of a wild idea because at that time, you could still have moments where you could feel like you're having a little bit of a pioneer experience. You know, you wouldn't want to forget something and be a day into that horseback ride.
Yeah, exactly. You can't go to Walgreens to get anything. Yeah.
You know, back there. So, like you said, they only lived at Philbrook for 11 years, yeah. Which when people find that out, you know, you build this amazing home. And the idea that you wouldn't, one, live there throughout the rest of your days, and two, it wouldn't, you know, kind of be passed down through generations and become this almost kind of in the English tradition almost of passing on these major homes. 11 years in, they say, we're going to leave this house and we're not going to sell it. We're not going to, you know, have someone else that we know move in here. We're going to basically give it over to the people of Tulsa and turn it into this thing. And they weren't big art collectors. Like, as far as everyone thinks that all the art in the museum is their stuff, and it wasn't.
They had a location. So there was a movement in Tulsa to have a museum. There were a group of people who knew that for Tulsa to be a viable cultural city, to draw people here and to be an economic force, then there needed to be an amazing library, a great symphony, a wonderful school system, and museums. And while the Phillipses didn't collect art necessarily, they had some pieces that they loved in their home, they had a location, they had a property. And so Mr. Phillips, as the sort of the public face of this family, he writes a letter, but he says, Mrs. Phillips and I wish to give. And they gave their home away to become a museum. So they made a nonprofit for the museum, for the gardens, for a place for the community to come together. And they said they wanted people to come to look at art, to learn about art, and to have a place for the community. And I think that hopefully we're still doing that.
Now, is this the Southwest Art?
Southwestern Art Association.
And so that was basically created to make this transition
right.
from the home to the museum it became. You mentioned, you know, they had some interesting pieces in the house, and there are pieces that you can see still throughout the museum. And what was in the area that is now called the Great Hall, which is where the original entrance was to the home? You walk in, there's this grand staircase. You can then also, if you wanted to, walk straight out into the gardens. But there are these two tapestries.
Two gorgeous, huge
tapestries.
Yeah.
Now, tapestries are just not something you see in the everyday house now in 2018.
No.
I don't know any of my friends who have tapestries. Do you know anybody who has tapestries of any kind of major?
Definitely not, no. You don't necessarily buy the tapestries at IKEA or Target.
What are these tapestries?
So there are these two tapestries, and Mr. and Mrs. Phillips bought them in 1929. So those walls were empty for two whole years before they bought those tapestries. There are these two beautiful tapestries, and there are figures kind of draped, and there's glorious gold and red and blue. And on one, there's a woman kind of with golden hair, and she's getting dressed, and jewelry is placed upon her. There's a mirror in front of her. So it's all this opulence and fabric and jewels
very,
and jewelry.
Very ornate.
Very ornate in this architectural setting with this gorgeous garden behind you. You can even extrapolate and think about the garden behind in Philbrook. And then on the other side, the woman, if she were to look over her shoulder, she would see two people clasping hands in this other tapestry with heavenly beings. And we know they're heavenly because some of them are floating. Floating on top of eagles or on a chariot, but there's these two people, the woman with the golden hair, and she's clasping hands with a man draped in a red cloth, but he has these big wings on the back, so almost eagle wings on his back. And because of those wings, we can figure out who this is supposed to be. So the wings mean that it's Cupid. So Cupid, the god of love, not the little cherub baby guy.
Yeah, he's not the little baby with that bow and arrow.
Right,
yeah.
Right. This is the full-grown Cupid. And he is getting married to this young woman. So the story of Cupid and Psyche is her name. So Psyche was the most beautiful woman, and she was so beautiful that the goddess of love, Venus, totally jealous. She hated her. So Venus sends her son, Cupid, who's very mischievous, and of course he has these arrows. And with an arrow, if you're pricked, then you fall in love with the first person you see. So her idea was that Cupid would make Psyche fall in love with a monster. Cupid sees her and goes, oh my God, the most beautiful woman in the world. Maybe he pricked himself with arrow, we don't know, but he falls in love with Psyche. So he takes her through magical means. He takes her to a palace, and the palace is completely empty. So there's virtual servants, if you will, ghosts or spirits that wait on her. And she's a little freaked out. It's a kind of like Beauty and the Beast.
It's kind of like Siri or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yeah.
You
so
can't see it, but
you
can't
see. Okay, there you go, Siri. So she's dressed, she's bathed, she has jewels. She gets to wander around this gorgeous palace, but there's no one there. At night, she goes into her bedroom and a guy comes.
So this is like a soap opera.
I know, it is. It's this amazing story. So the next morning, she wakes up, but the guy has left. And this happens day after day.
Oh, okay.
And so she has to figure out who this guy is because it might be a monster. So she has a knife just in case she can kill this guy. And she has a lamp. And she lights the lamp. It's dark. It's night. This man has fallen asleep. So she lights the lamp to see who it is. And she has her knife in her other hand just in case. And she looks at the man and she sees him for the first time. And she realizes it's Cupid. He's this beautiful man. And she's so shocked, she shakes, and the oil from her lamp spills onto his shoulder. And he wakes up. He realizes that she didn't trust him. So he disappears. He forces her out of the palace, all because she didn't trust him. And, you know, I don't blame her.
Do you think
at
some
all.
Counseling would have been helpful
I think
for
so.
These two?
Absolutely. There
okay.
is a little
I mean,
bit
they
of.
They didn't have these options.
There's
at that
a little
time.
Kind of grief factor
okay.
here. But she's decided that she's fallen in love with him. She has to go through all of these tasks to win him back long time. She has to win over Venus. I mean, it's a whole big thing. And finally, they get back together, and the gods sanction their marriage. They're married on Mount Olympus. Probably it's better that Cupid is not out wooing other women and making other people fall in love. He can focus on Psyche, so they get married. And so Cupid, who is love, marries Psyche, which is the soul, And so love and the soul are joined together in the presence of all of the gods. So this beautiful, huge tapestry has Jupiter with his thunderbolts and the eagle, and Venus with her swans, and they're getting married in front of an altar with the sacred fire. And so these two tapestries have hung at Philbrook since 1929.
But as you said, these were not purchased from the Sears Roebuck catalog.
That is true.
They have a pretty long history. Where were they before Philbrook?
Well,
how did they even get to Philbrook?
They are from the 18th century, so they were made probably around 1745, 1750. And from recent research, we now know that they were most likely made or purchased by Maria Theresa of Austria, so the most powerful woman in Europe. She purchased them, and she asked that her seal, so her the great big arms, the coat of arms, are stitched onto the top near the border, and that's Maria Theresa's imprint. It's her signature. She says, these are mine. And she probably actually purchased them as a gift. So she gave them to a young officer from Hanover in Germany, and probably to say, look, you have to be friends with me. I'm the most important person in Europe, and my seal is still upon them, but I'm giving you this incredibly important gift. These two tapestries are probably from a set of seven, illustrating the whole story of Cupid and Psyche. And they were, at least by around 1815, they were transferred to the King of Hanover, the collection of the King of Hanover. And a little bit after that, around, I think, 1837, the King of Hanover, through another twist of fate, a woman becomes Queen of England, so Victoria. Her uncle, Ernest Augustus, becomes King of Hanover because, of course, they're Hanoverian dynasty. But because the only title that she cannot inherit as a woman is the King of Hanover. And so that title is the only one that she passes down then to her uncle, and he becomes King of Hanover. And those tapestries stay in the Hanoverian collection until about 1918, probably, so right after World War I. Europe is devastated. The houses, the royal houses, are trying to raise funds to help with infrastructure. And somehow those tapestries end up at auction. And then in 1929, they are offered to the Phillipses by Percy French, who is their almost like an interior decorator, interior designer, who lives in New York City. And he says, hey, guys, I found these beautiful tapestries. They'd be perfect for your entryway. You know, normally we think perfect for entryway, like a little painting or something. But these are,
Yeah.
These are two tapestries made or purchased for Maria Theresa of Austria in various royal families.
Now, Maria Theresa of Austria, we're burying the lead somewhere.
Oh, there's the other is a lead.
People probably know who she is,
right?
But her daughter was
probably more famous.
Let's not give it away.
Okay, let's not give it. So Maria Theresa of Austria, another actually great love story. So she marries Francis I, who becomes Holy Roman Emperor, and they have 16 kids. There is definitely a love story there, 16 kids. She likes to name things after herself. So all of her daughters are Maria something. So Maria Amalia, Maria Carolina, Maria Elisabetta, Maria Antonia. And Maria Antonia, when she gets married, she changes her name to Marie Antoinette. So these tapestries were purchased by Marie Antoinette's mother.
So when you walk in and you see these magnificent tapestries, they really do tell stories. I mean, was that the point of them at the time, to kind of have a narrative, or to just be, you know, were they intended to tell a story or just be decor?
I think beautiful objects, beautiful objects that tell a story. And of course, it's not a story of two farmers in a field. They're stories of the ultimate royalty, the gods and goddesses. So you have an amazing love story, a story that shows the opulence of the architecture and the gardens, everything that was important in 18th century Europe to the royalty and to the most powerful beings, who are the gods and goddesses. So it's all about power right there, power and beauty.
There's a lot of love in that space.
Mm-hmm. So much of that space is about love. And I love that also that it was a family that brought those objects to Tulsa that now the community can enjoy.
Well, we love talking with you today. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Get past the people, get past the hitman. Get on down now. I want to get on the good foot. I got to get on the good foot. Going down to the trail.
William Bouguereau was a French realist painter who lived from 1825 to 1905. He created nearly 1,000 paintings in his lifetime that we know of. His main area of focus was the female form, and he's responsible for the painting most often associated with Philbrook, a work from 1889 officially called The Little Shepherdess, but more commonly called The Shepherdess. Lucas Wrench joined our education team last year with the specific task of helping with our interpretation needs. In museum speak, interpretation basically means helping visitors better understand and connect to the art and the museum. Lucas has also been doing a little digging into some of Bouguereau's lesser-known interests. You came to Philbrook from a place that has recently ceased operations. It was a really fascinating place called the Machine Project in California. How long were you there for?
I was at Machine Project for 3 years. And I worked as their associate curator doing, like, basically we had a small storefront in Echo Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. And so we'd use that for lectures, performances, workshops. We had a 17-seat Victorian-style theater in the basement that we used for a lot of projects.
Everyone needs one of those.
Exactly. And and then we would also invite artists to do projects at larger institutions. So
the Machine Project, for people that don't know, was hugely influential space. You know, did programming that you wouldn't expect, things that, you know, people were pushing the boundaries of what art spaces can do, and, you mm-hmm. know, is it a museum? Is it art? You know, like, kind of blurring the edges between a lot of things. And you personally took part in some really interesting programming. Can you kind of tell us a few of the things that you were most proud of doing while you were there?
Yeah, well, I was actually thinking about some of the events I went to even before I started working there. Like,
when you were kind of fanning, enjoying their work.
Yeah. Like, I think the first project I went to was a aerobics workshop that was aerobics and butter churning. So you
at the same time
you shake, there was a DJ, and you shake jars of cream and turn that into butter.
I've done this before when I was in kindergarten. We did this,
yeah,
not through aerobics. It was more just like shake up this thing of cream and turn to butter. But
exactly, but so they kind of
standing process
merge the two. I got hypnotized there. I went to a mind reading workshop.
All before you started working
there. These were before I started working there. And then at Machine Project, we did an entire show underwater in a pool at the Annenberg Beach House in Los Angeles on Santa Monica Beach.
So was it art under the water? And then
art
people
was,
had to go under the water to look at?
Yeah.
Or some kind of viewing portal?
You had to go swimming. And so you had snorkel gear and... yeah, so there was paintings, there was some floating sculptures, there was a donut of ice with mosquito larvae in it that melted into the pool over the course of the day.
And then just mosquitoes were born.
Exactly.
Started stinging people.
Exactly.
Or biting people or whatever mosquitoes do. This is kind of like that famous story that Bill Gates was giving a presentation once.
Oh, right.
About malaria.
And released the jar of mosquitoes.
And he said that they were infected with malaria. Everybody freaked out. That's kind of an interesting art moment in a way, too.
That
seems like a Machine Project worthy.
There's definitely, like, what was it?
The line between prank and art performance. I mean, it's kind of pushing these
right
things.
Like, one airline recently announced, like, in-flight concerts, which I feel like is a very Machine Project idea. Art in unexpected places.
You came to Philbrook with the desire of bringing some of that spirit to our museum, to Tulsa, to this space, which has been around for so long and certainly on occasion needs a shot in the arm of some fresh ideas. And you've brought a lot of that to the museum, but you've also been doing some, I'm going to call it private eye work, you've been doing some investigations and into... William Bouguereau, and Bouguereau is one of the probably most iconic artists in the Philbrook collection, known for doing The Shepherdess, and is someone that people are very familiar with in this community because they know that piece so well, they've grown up with it. So who was this guy?
Right. Bouguereau, William Adolphe Bouguereau, is he was a very prominent figure painter in the 1800s, mostly known for depicting women, and working class women was kind of the main focus of his body of work. He was working mid-1800s France. So that's the same time that like the Impressionists, Manet, Monet are coming up. And Bouguereau kind of represent, he was kind of part of the old guard in some ways. So he was very much part of the academy, where Monet and Manet were getting rejected from these institutions for kind of pushing the boundaries a little too far. Bouguereau was being very celebrated by, like...
Yeah, and he was very famous in his own life and popular.
Yeah, the Beaux-Arts Academy, for example. But then, for those same reasons, as the Impressionists rose in fame, Bouguereau kind of descended into some relative obscurity until, I think, around 1980s, when there was sort of a resurgence in interest in figure painting and realism. And some institutions in particular have that kind of championed his work as this model of figurative realism.
So he's got a lot of fans now. I mean, his reputation has certainly come back and he's considered a pretty major player. But he has one group of people that really love his work.
Yes. So the focus of my investigations into Bouguereau have been viewing his work through the lens of foot fetishism, which... I can't say for certain that Bouguereau had a foot fetish, but what we can say is he painted approximately 844 paintings of barefooted women. We can say that he is featured prominently in image collections, in foot fetish-related databases and image collections. He's often cited as a painter who has very erotic depictions of feet. And he's also considered among art historians possibly the greatest painter of feet and hands.
Setting aside whether we know for sure or not that he had this predilection, which we don't know for
right.
sure, but you're still working on it. This investigation is ongoing.
It's an ongoing,
right?
Yes.
It's ongoing. But we do know that people in that world love his work. That's for sure.
That
you see
is clear.
When you've been doing this deep investigation and you've had to go on these foot fetish sites, Bouguereau is popping up everywhere, right?
Or more frequently, I'll be on a site looking at paintings of his work and then I'll realize that this is a foot fetish site. You'll be on a website, you won't realize it's foot fetish related, but then as you go deeper into the other images in the collection, it becomes clear that these are some of the kind of main accumulators of his work online.
So you talked about the fact that he is considered to be one of the great painters in terms of painting hands and feet. You know, if he's the expert guy on feet and hands, why are people just going, you know, feet? Doesn't he need to get a little love for his
depiction
work?
Of hands?
Yeah.
I think what it comes down to is kind of the way the feet are deployed in his paintings. I mean, I think it's helpful to think about, like, kind of the taboos of the moment that he was painting in. So, like, 1850s, at that same time, Manet was getting in trouble for example, luncheon on the grass. It's a nude woman having a picnic in a public park, and she's surrounded by clothed men. And that was considered this very kind of risque, almost vulgar painting, because not only was she nude surrounded by clothed men, but she looked more like a modern 19th century French woman instead of the mythological nude that was safer or more standard at the time. Similarly, his painting Olympia.
Yeah, it's not like a Botticelli or something.
Right,
like
exactly. Olympia is mirrored after a Titian painting, but she's considered to have a vulgarly flexed hand. So
I love that term.
Exactly.
Vulgarly flexed hand.
So it's this era where little tiny signifiers like that, like a flexed hand or like tensed fingers, these...
Were these things intentional by all accounts? Or was it just something people were picking out little...
It's always hard to say what the original intention was, but... I mean, the common read of Manet's Olympia is that it depicts like a 19th century sex worker instead of this mythological nude woman.
So it's a commentary of some kind. Basically.
Exactly.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by that nearly empty donation box. You know the kind. Every museum has one somewhere near the entrance. made of plexi, and usually only sparsely filled with singles and the occasional five. Why is it always empty? Here's the secret. They keep it that way. Would you stick another dollar in a box overflowing with cash? It's Fundraising 101, people, the perception of need. So the next time you visit a museum, find the nearly empty donation box, shoot a knowing wink to the front desk, and fork over a buck or two, or maybe a 10 spot. Support the things you love.
So I wonder, what in your mind is the difference? And let's just point out, you're not an art historian.
I am not
an
art historian.
You're coming at this from a kind of more of an educational angle.
Yes.
And just a general curiosity. But what is the difference in your mind between obsession and fetish? Is fetish always tied in with sexuality? Could it just be something that he just was obsessed with it? You know, those two words have somewhat different meanings.
Right.
But also there's overlap.
It's a good question. It is hard to make a clear boundary between obsession and fetish. I think what happens in Bouguereau's paintings are these women are sexualized, and often they're being sexualized. So Bouguereau, for example, he does paint nudes, but they're not explicit nudes for the most part. So a lot of these women are clothed, but the only skin that you're seeing is their bare feet. The Freudian term is like displacement, so displacing the genitals onto another part of the body, or displacing this sexual desire onto this other part of the body. And so I think where the fetishism comes is in the way that that desire is applied to the feet. So I think there's like a few paintings in general where you can really see that. The biggest one is his painting Before the Bath, where it's a young woman. I think it's the same model as in The Shepherdess. She's removing her sock. And so in this way, like her whole state of undress, she's undressing, but it's all being displaced.
It's captured kind of mid-removal of the
exactly.
sock.
Exactly. Her sock
like is a striptease of
halfway off, halfway peeled off, like just on the sole of her, on the arch. So that's another thing is foot fetishism. First of all, it's a very common fetish, arguably the most common fetish there is. So kind of the common features are like a lot of arches of the foot, the sole of the foot, toes. It's not your standard like frontal or top-down foot in a flip-flop that you might just be captured in.
I mean, from a figurative standpoint, you could argue that the foot, just as a thing, has these contours. It almost is like a body in and of itself, right? It has
right.
so many different things going on with it, as
yes.
opposed to your hand, which is kind of just this thing. It doesn't have the kind of bulbous ball of the foot, and the toes do their own thing, and you have this contour of your arch and all these different things. So it kind of is a figure in and of itself.
Right. I think there's like a Da Vinci quote about the human foot as this exquisite machine. And yeah, this highly complex creation.
How did you even kind of get the first idea to start looking into this? Why did you even go down this path?
Actually, my aunt, who had lived in Tulsa, was telling me, before I came to the Philbrook, she was telling me that her only association with the Philbrook was The Shepherdess, and that she actually had attended a talk about Bouguereau's facility for painting feet. And it was all kind of focused on how masterful a painter of feet he was. And so when I got to the Philbrook and I saw The Shepherdess for the first time.
That was just kind of rattling around.
It's rattling in my head. And I mean, as I said, he's painted 844 plus barefoot women. And yeah, the more you get into it, it just becomes really clear. There's like beams of light shining on feet.
Like, look at this.
It's very, I mean, part of it is because of he's so good at painting feet, but they really kind of glow in the painting. Like The Shepherdess even is like these really three centers of light in the painting. It's on her two hands and her feet forming this like cross shape. And similarly, you know, Bouguereau does a version of Botticelli's Venus, and there's a beam of light shining down onto the sole of her foot in this painting. So it's kind of, it feels like when you view it in mass, it becomes really difficult to dismiss.
Put your little foot, put your little foot, put your little foot right out. put your little foot, put your little foot, put your little foot right out.
Put your arm around, put your arm around, put your arm around my waist. Keep your arm around, keep your arm around, keep your arm around my waist.
Take a step.
Hey, this is Scott Gregory, and normally we would conclude the show with some sort of historical anecdote about this or that aspect of art history and maybe a little interesting story, but this is Jeff, the host of the show, with a personal essay.
In a certain kind of way, art saved my life. In March 2002, my best friend died suddenly. He'd just turned 22, and I wouldn't until later that summer. The next few months, I was a wreck, having panic attacks instead of sleep, wide awake in bed, feeling as if my heart would burst from my chest. I was generally aimless, having had most of my future plans tied up with ideas and schemes that my best friend and I would do together at some point. I was working at a bookstore and mostly keeping a brave face to the public. I'd been dating and going out a fair amount before everything happened, but nothing since. A few months later, I began to take notice of a girl who'd recently started working at the bookstore part-time. Aside from mostly work-related interactions, we didn't talk much. She didn't seem interested in me at all. One day, standing around the information desk at the center of the store, we were hanging around, chatting. She was thumbing through a big coffee table art book and started talking about Edward Hopper. I asked her if she had a favorite piece, and she opened the book to a 1927 painting of his called Automat. It's a somber scene of a woman alone in a cafe. She's wearing one glove. I asked if she'd ever seen it in person. She hadn't. The book said it was in the collection of the Des Moines Art Center in Iowa. For some reason still unknown to me, I told her we should take a road trip and go see it. Not her, we. Without a beat, she said yes. And a few days later, we were on the road in her hunter green Jeep Cherokee headed toward Des Moines. Her parents were less than thrilled about her taking a long road trip with a guy who was a stranger for all intents and purposes. Looking back, I don't blame them. I had no money, just enough to help with gas and pitch in on some shady motel rooms and cheap food. I brought my music. Tons of CDs with cracked cases. She'd never listened to The Doors or The White Stripes. Along with David Gray, her favorite at the time, they became the soundtrack to our journey. We talked for hours, laughed at everything, and took the long way. We made it to Des Moines but didn't really care about the painting by the time we got there, lost in the intoxicating haze that only happens when two people truly connect for the first time. Why not take a different way back and stop in Chicago? We did. By the time we got back, we were together and have been ever since. Every good thing in my life that's happened after can be traced back to that trip. That moment, in my personal history, is as legendary as Arthur pulling the sword from the stone. But that's only inside my mind, my heart. To quote Edward Hopper, if you could say it in words, there would be no reason to paint.
Embers of the fire. My heart smolders in the night, and these tumbling boulders of desire. And we're rolling out the shadows of me. Rolling out the shadows of me.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.